is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello and welcome to the program. Coming up, we'll hear more from the Bushfire Royal Commission, and also farmers in the Central West. They're reaping the benefits of the rain this year as confidence levels soar.
I've actually said to my kids who are teenagers, I said, you remember this autumn? It might be a long time before we see another autumn like this. Yeah, just the turnaround from the previous years is just phenomenal.
You might have some thoughts about the season so far. You can share them with us on the text line 0467 922 684. But first up today to floodplain harvesting and more reaction to the figures released last week showing 30 gigalitres of water was taken during the lifting of an embargo in February, and about 400 to 500 gigalitres has been stored in dams since from a variety of water sources. Environment group Inland Rivers says the 30 gigalitre number is low, but the amount of water taken since the New South Wales and Queensland from the New South Wales and Queensland side of the border is a much bigger concern, and they're worried about a move to license previously unlicensed floodplain harvesting and describe it as a massive wealth shift. Mel Day told David Claughton that previously unlicensed works diverting water from the floodplain were all approved temporarily to enact the embargo, and that hasn't been revoked as yet.
First, it gave a right to all the existing infrastructure, even the stuff that wasn't approved, and then put an embargo on and then lifted it, you know, put the embargo back. It was, you know, we didn't know where to look, what was going on. It was crazy. It was on, it was off, and we've ended up with this regulation in the legislation that has approved all of these old infrastructures.
That is meant to be peeled back, though, isn't it?
Well, let's hope so. There's a parliamentary inquiry into it now, and there's a survey online. Submission's due by the 31st of May, so let's hope that that definitely gets looked at.
Now, the bigger picture, of course, is that the government is trying to regulate floodplain harvesting and license it and bring it within the Murray-Darling Basin plan. So these numbers are an important early indicator, aren't they, of how sustainable the plan might be, what kind of number might be put on that floodplain harvesting. So the other figure that came out yesterday from the analysts was that they understand from their technological surveys that the dams are about one-third full in the New South Wales side of the Northern Basin, and that represents a figure of around 400 to 500 gigalitres. What's your take on the significance of that number?
That's a very significant number. And we've known that that floodplain harvesting takes an awful lot of water off the floodplains and withholds it from the rivers. There's been no moves to assess the cumulative environmental impact and social and economic impact of floodplain harvesting is had on the Darling and lower down in tributaries, which really should be done before any compensable, tradable licences are handed out for floodplain harvesting.
But the government is saying, and the irrigators are saying too, that they have for the first time missed out on water that they're entitled to. They've let the bulk of the water go through, and we have seen significant flows past Bourke, 700 gigalitres going past there, all the way down to Menindee. So that's been a breakthrough, really, hasn't it, for a lot of those downstream communities and irrigators and the environment?
Well, I think we really need to look closely at the protection of first flush flows after such a severe drought. We had the Natural Resources Commission come out and call the Darling an ecosystem in collapse, in crisis. We had critical human need not met at the end of the system, and we had take upstream. I think, put it in context of the severity of the drought that we're still in, and the importance to people and the environment of those first flush, that first flow after a drought, wasn't considered at all, and that's a critical element of water sharing plans for the Darling, the Barwon and the tributary rivers, including the Macquarie, that is missing from these water sharing plans.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of the crucial water sharing plans yet, but what we do know is that those areas in the Northern Basin are also severely impacted by drought. They've been on zero allocation in some of those areas for 3 years. And so this is a very important moment for those communities, those farmers as well. They're still on, in the Gwydir, just 1.9% of allocation.
Well, here in the Macquarie, there's been crops grown every year. There hasn't been an allocation in the Macquarie for 2 years, but there's been carryover, healthy carryover accounts from a full 100% allocation in 2016. The groundwater licences are at 100%, even though what's happening to the groundwater. So we've had, even in the most severe drought when Dubbo was on its knees and we were looking at the barrel of losing the Macquarie from Burrendong down, we had cotton being irrigated by flood irrigation on groundwater. So sure, you can say that there's no allocation, but there's carryover, there's groundwater, there's crops growing.
The cotton crop, though, was significantly lower, wasn't it? Like 10%, I think.
It wasn't up to the astronomical records that they had in 2017, 2016, yeah.
So what's your take overall on the progress of the floodplain harvesting process, of bringing that into the regulated system?
Well, until they assess the cumulative environmental, social, economic impact that floodplain harvesting has had on the environment over these decades, they should not be handing out tradable, compensable new property rights. When floodplain harvesting licences come out, it's going to be the biggest issue of property rights since the 90s. It's a massive amount of a wealth shift, a tradable, compensable property right. That's what these floodplain harvesting licences are. And the cumulative impact and the cost to the environment and societies and communities downstream needs to be assessed before these compensable, tradable property rights are handed out.
And when do you think those announcements will be made? When will the government?
They're due to be made next year, 2021. So there's a lot they have to get right, and they've taken their time. They were due to be handed out a couple of years ago. But it's very important that they get it right, because any adjustments to the volumes will mean compensation to be paid. So for the public purses and all of our benefit, we should be looking very closely at this and making sure that those volumes are correct. There's a 500% carryover rule in there, which means if it doesn't flood for 5 years, and we know it doesn't flood every 5 years, then the 100% of their entitlement gets rolled over for 5 years. So when they announce the volume, we might as well multiply that by five.
That's Mel Day from Environment Group Inland Rivers. We approached Water Minister Melinda Pavey for a response over the last few days, but she's declined so far. The inquiry Mel Day mentioned is the one into the impact and implementation of the Water Management Amendment exemptions to floodplain harvesting. It closes on the 31st of May, although that may have actually been changed to June the 7th. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 13 minutes past 12. Well, irrigators in the Macquarie Valley don't see eye to eye with this issue on inland rivers. Tony Quigley is the chairman of Macquarie Food and Fibre and says about 80% of the first flush from the flood in February went to the environment, and inland rivers' concerns about floodplain harvesting are unfounded. He explained to David Claughton how much water was taken in the Macquarie during that flood, given the historic embargo on that first flush.
There were five events through February, March and April, of which the irrigators were able to access three of the particularly bigger events, where flows exceeded or nearly exceeded 20,000 metres a day at Narromine. So it allowed the irrigators some access to water, some supplementary, and also a small amount of floodplain harvesting that probably equates to around 20% of the total flows. So 80% of that water has gone down the effluent creeks. Nearly all of them got a run, including the Gunningbarra and the lower Bogan right through to the Darling, as well as good flows into the marshes. And we've seen inundations there of more than 35,000 hectares of the reed beds and river gum country. So
you've been down there, haven't you?
I have, yes, to the northern reed bed, the northern reserve area. It's fantastic. The reeds are now over 2 metres tall, so they've recovered really well from that October reed bed fire that burnt them out badly. The trees are still a bit scarred and they're putting leaves back on them, but certainly the reed bed looking over the top of it looks fantastic and recovering really well, which is, very pleasing to see.
Now, the embargo was the first time the first flush has been protected.
So how did it work from your perspective as an irrigator, not being able to take the water that was running past your door?
Well, I'm not a floodplain harvester, so from my point of view, it didn't make any difference to us. But we only have a small number of floodplain harvesters in the Macquarie, down the bottom end of the river, well below Warren. And they, I think, were happy enough to see that first flush go through. They understood the critical environmental needs that were met down there. We had a little bit more trouble getting supplementary events approved at the time, even though they weren't embargoed under that embargo or suspended under the water sharing plan. So there was a bit of toing and froing, but at the end of the day, everyone got, I think, a good share. And the way that split worked was about what the irrigators take in the Macquarie generally, around that 20%. And the environment, one way or another, got about 80%. So I think everyone was reasonably comfortable with the way it's performed, and it's been a good result.
The big concern from the southern part of the basin is that too much water is being taken from the north. They point the finger at floodplain harvesting because it's not really part of the system and hasn't been licensed and regulated in the same way. So do you think that the balance is right, or are you concerned about the licensing process that's still to come?
Well, a lot of people like to overstate the volume of water that's been taken. People look at storages from satellites and say, oh, you know, it's a third full or whatever, but they have to really understand where that water's come from, or whether it's rainfall runoff that's happened off irrigated fields. And we certainly had irrigated fields here that backed up with water and we pumped off into storage. But on top of that, you've got things like supplementary flow and unregulated license that people are allowed to access under certain conditions. So to blame it all on floodplain harvesting is probably a big stick. And I think one of the best things about getting this regulation process finished, which is really only transferring a written in entitlement or a written description into a volume, will allow reportability and accountability of those volumes, and we'll finally get some science about what the numbers are, which might reduce the speculation of about what water take is happening.
Because some people do say the water take from the Northern Basin, you know, on the Queensland and New South Wales side, is as high as, you know, over 4,000 gigs. Is that a credible number in your view?
Well, David, I'm not an expert on the rest of the Murray-Darling Basin, but it sounds like a big number to me.
When the department did all this surveying of dams in the Northern Basin on the New South Wales side, they found about 1,300 plus dams, and they thought they could hold about 1,450 gigalitres. Would that be a more accurate figure of what the take might be every year?
Yes, but we need to understand where that water's come from. And not all of it is floodplain harvesting. Everyone's making a very quick jump from dams filling to floodplain harvesting when, as I mentioned earlier, there is other avenues where that water's come from. So I think let's wait and get this process finished so there is an accountability process, a measurement process, and there'll be confidence about what the number is. I think at the moment it's really wild speculation.
But if more of that take is licensed and the number is up around, you know, 1,000 gig even, is the Murray-Darling Basin plan going to be sustainable? Are the southern parts of the basin going to be able to operate? Because we are hearing that there's less water in the system generally. And so if we license an extra, you know, number of gigs, it's going to make it pretty hard, isn't it?
Well, it's not an extra number of gigs, though, David. It's already a right that exists. So that's just being formalised. This argument that it's new water or a new take is a fallacy. It is already a right.
It's not incorporated in the plan, though, is it, apart from a very small number?
No, but it will be, and that is the reason that New South Wales is taking its time through this process to try to get the numbers right, is that it is the only development that existed in 2008. So there is already a handbrake on any expansion on that water take, and it will actually take us back to that volume once the process is finished. So taken the right was already there. It is simply putting a number around it so it falls into these all these water sharing plans that need to go to the MDBA. And that's the real underlying point here. This is not new take. It's not looking to expand. In fact, it'll reduce the amount of water that's been able to be taken, in my view.
Tony Quigley is the chairman of Macquarie Food and Fibre. We approached the Water Minister, Melinda Pavey, over the response for that for the last few days, which she's declined to comment. Her office did issue a revised estimate of the water held in dams after that flood event, down from 400 or 500 gigalitres to 350 gigalitres. The overall take from New South Wales from the Murray-Darling Basin is 6,600 gigalitres. On the Country Hour, it's 20 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the Bushfire Royal Commission is today focusing on threatened and endangered species, including the bogs and alpine fens in the ACT, the Wallamai Pines in New South Wales, and the eastern bristlebirds in Victoria. It's hearing from a range of federal and state and territory bureaucrats and the Threatened Species Commissioner, Dr. Sally Box. Our reporter, Karen Thomas, has been covering the commission for us. She joins us again today. Karen, so what have we heard from Dr. Box this morning?
Well, Dr. Sally Box has been providing an insight into the impact on native wildlife from the bushfires, and it's not very good news at all. She said that the impact has been severe, and she described it as an ecological disaster. She said the fires covered an unusually large area, and in many places they burnt with an unusually high intensity. So there are currently 1,800 federally listed threatened species. There are more than 300 of those where 10% of their known or likely distribution was within the extent of the fires. Let's hear more from Dr. Sally Box about
that. The entire known range of some species was burnt. Of the 327 species in the path of the fire, 49 threatened species had more than 80% of their known or likely range within the fire extent, and a further 65 threatened species had more than 50% of their known or likely range within the fire extent. And this includes plants and mammals and birds and frogs and reptiles and fish and invertebrates. So for some species that were considered threatened before the fires have now likely increased their risk of extinction. But there are also many other fire-affected species that were considered secure before the fires, but who've now lost much of their habitat and might be imperiled.
So Dr. Box was asked if she could put a number on how many additional species might be threatened or endangered that were considered secure before the fires. She said she just didn't have a number, but it is something that's being looked at now. And she said that there's likely to be a large number of species considered for assessment and inclusion under the EPBC Act as threatened or endangered. She said it could be well within to the hundreds.
Okay, and as a result of the situation we're in now, Dr. Box was also saying that we're learning some stuff.
I don't know if it can be really described as a silver lining, but she said that we are learning a lot in the recovery process that we're in now that will help feed into better preparation in the future. We're learning a lot about the impact of fire on different species. Let's hear again from Dr. Box.
Partly because that we're seeing some areas burn that don't traditionally burn, areas like rainforest ecosystems. And so we will learn from this about the types of impacts that fire can have on those ecosystems and on those species. And these are the sort of learnings that can then be incorporated into recovery plans and conservation advices. They can be updated so that they can reflect our better understanding of the potential impacts of fire and the types of recovery actions that can potentially help in terms of building resilience and or recovery from fire.
Dr. Sally Box again, and so obviously a whole range of issues been raised by that and by the fire severity as well. What are we expecting to hear for the rest of the day in evidence?
So at the moment, we're hearing from some experts from the ACT government. We're also expecting to hear from the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Victorian Department of Environment. We're expecting to hear another direct experience from a community member. That's someone from Kangaroo Island sharing what they went through. And we're also expecting to hear from an Indigenous elder from Portland in Victoria.
Okay, well, we'll no doubt be getting the details of that and a whole lot more tomorrow when we speak again.
Thanks, Michael.
Karen Thomas there, who's been casting an ear over the Royal Commission, the Bushfire Royal Commission. Of course, it's been done remotely, and we've been keeping tabs of it here at the ABC. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 25 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, farmers in the central west of the state are reaping the rewards and reaping the benefits of the rain this year as confidence levels are soaring as well. Above average rain since February has seen plenty of crops going into the ground and finally some light at the end of the tunnel for many. Tim Fuchs has this report.
As far as autumn breaks go in the Central West, this year's is certainly one of the best.
I've actually said to my kids, who are teenagers, I said, you remember this autumn. It might be a long time before we see another autumn like this. Yeah, just the turnaround from the previous years is just phenomenal.
That's Peter Unger, who's a sheep grazier and cropper at Alecktown, north of Parkes. He's planted rows of barley this autumn, trying to make the most of the sudden turnaround in the season.
It's a rotational thing. You can duck and weave a little bit, but at the end of the day, you've got to stick, in my opinion, to your rotation.
It's a bit of a talking point at the moment, barley, obviously with the trade issues that have been created through China. What's your plan for the barley?
It's 5 months until it's ready. We haven't made any decisions yet. I think it's a lot of water to go under the bridge yet. Hopefully, we do try and grow some malt barley, so, you know, hopefully it can be used domestically. But, yeah, otherwise it probably does go to China. I'm not 100% sure where it ends up. Probably try and sell most of it domestically, privately.
And what kind of volumes are you looking at?
We could end up with 1,500 tonne of barley.
How are stock numbers looking at the moment?
We built a containment lot late last year. My only regret was that I probably didn't build it earlier. So we've managed to keep most of our breeding stock. We have lightened off probably 10 or 15%. So we've managed to keep most of them on hand, and they're due to lamb in about 10 days' time.
As sowing wraps up around Parkes, heading into winter, agronomist Peter Yelland says farmers in the region have already received anywhere between 250 and 400 millimetres of rain. That's more than for the last 2 years combined. He says that's set the region up well.
Naturally, coming out of the drought, there's been a big planting of grazing crops, so cereal and broadleaf crop, brassicas. And of course, at the moment, they're probably 2 to 3 weeks ahead of normal in terms of grazing timing. So long and short is nobody can keep these grazing crops under control. So, and of course, stock are very expensive to be able to purchase and hard to source as well. We are in a really nice position in terms of moisture profile, and things aren't overly wet. If we have above average rain in the next couple of months, things would get wet. So it'll be hard from a management point of view for growers. So it'll be nice just to have an average winter, and then hopefully can turn it on properly in the spring.
I heard someone the other day, a farmer, saying we seem to be in a bit of a cycle in New South Wales where you have 2 or 3 quite dry years or very dry years, and then you get a bit of rain. You've been around a while. Are you sort of seeing that kind of trend?
I guess what we've seen in the last, say, 20 years is extremes. So we're either seeing extremely dry or extremely wet. So 2016, we had double our growing season rainfall in the growing season, and we couldn't do a thing about it. We couldn't move. Management was very hard, and things suffered. And then, of course, we went into the drought really started in the spring of 17, and then continued on till January this year, basically.
Are we showing signs of recovery? Is it too soon to say that the drought's broken?
Oh, there's no doubt we've seen a complete turnaround in where we were in mid-January, for example. So I think the main thing is there's two things that we've been really lacking. One is food and the other one is water. And most areas in west of the Newell have both at the moment. But the best part about the whole, since the rain has actually started, is it's just bred confidence in people. So people are confident to make decisions and take risk, calculated risk, hopefully.
For farmer Peter Unger, while the full dams and green pasture are a sign the drought is easing in a physical sense, he says what's important to remember is financially, this drought will linger for a lot longer.
I would think that most people are mentally in a better space. Financially, no. And it's going to take more than this season to pull some people out of the financial bind that they found themselves in, with sowing crops and not harvesting, or harvesting very little, and then the fodder costs that they endured. There's a road ahead, and everyone's in a different situation depending on how long that is.
That's Alecktown farmer Peter Unger ending that report by Tim Fuchs. You're listening to The Country Hour, 29 minutes past 12. We'll find out what's happening with the weather details shortly, but before we do that, let's go to some news headlines now with Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. Public servants in New South Wales will have their pay rises frozen for 12 months as the government tries to address unemployment caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The state's treasurer, Dominic Perrottet, says the pay freeze will save the government around $3 billion. Contact tracing is underway after the COVID-related death of a 30-year-old man in central Queensland. He's the youngest person in Australia to die from the illness. The Bushfire Royal Commission has heard around a fifth of Australia's already endangered or threatened species were caught up in the 2019 and 2020 bushfires. The Threatened Species Commissioner, Sally Box, has told the hearing the full picture of the devastation is still being assessed, but says the number so far is staggering. And maritime authorities predict surgical masks and other debris could be washing up along the state's beaches for weeks from containers lost overboard last weekend. Debris has been washing up along the central coast overnight and is drifting south towards Sydney after 40 containers were lost overboard. And there'll be more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
And not to mention the short shorts.
Well. There are no reporting of short sightings at the moment, Michael, but you'll be the first to know.
As soon as we do. You're on top of that one.
Yep, that's okay. It. We have people in
people everywhere.
Key positions.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. Adam's story there with the news and a bit of frivolity as well. We're having trouble getting hold of the Weather Bureau at the moment. There seems to be some problem with the phone line there, so we'll keep trying on that. But before we do that, we'll look at the issue of coal, because the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated plunging prices for thermal coal, prompting a Hunter Valley underground coal mine to partially shut its operations. In a statement, US Energy Corporation Peabody says it will temporarily suspend part of its Wombo underground mine west of Singleton for 59 days while maintaining essential development to support future production. Tim Buckley is from the Pro Renewables Institute, the Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, and says in the last 6 weeks, the thermal coal price has fallen 25%. He says it's better for the company to do it proactively than to wait until it gets smashed.
Ultimately, Peabody is responding to the very, very clear market signal that has come through in the last 6 weeks. The Newcastle 6,000 kcal benchmark coal price has dropped 25% literally in the last 4 to 6 weeks. It's down at $50-$52 a tonne. At that price, most thermal coal mines in the Hunter Valley are marginal. Many of them will actually be below cost. And so it is a sensible, necessary outcome. And it's worth bearing in mind, the coal price has dropped 25% in 6 weeks. The LNG price has dropped 60%, 70% in the same time frame. And at the end of the day, our major export destinations like Korea and China and Japan are also our biggest export destinations for LNG. So they are very price responsive and they will switch from coal-fired power to gas-fired power on the back of price differentials. It's as much to do with the price war in the oil market as it is to do with the collapse in demand from the COVID-19 pandemic. And I mean, we've talked about the fact that electricity demand is down 20-25% in the last month, year on year in India. It's had a huge impact, double-digit declines in demand in recent weeks. There's also another thing going on here, and that is that China is clearly not happy with the Australian political landscape. Our political response on blaming China has certainly backfired. It's always dangerous to blame your biggest trading partner for starting a global pandemic. That was always going to bite us, and I would expect, and I think Peabody's actions in the New South Wales coal export industry has to take into account, China is threatening to put sanctions on Australian thermal coal exports to China. They did it 2 years ago. They will just say they're going to test the product. They don't actually have to formalise anything, and I think Australia needs to recognise we can't go attacking our biggest trade partner without a inevitable trade response.
The reports that we are hearing about some power plants in China having been told to stop importing Australian coal could be correct.
I would say it's absolutely correct. I mean, you'll never prove it because it is China, and China is not exactly a transparent democracy. But yeah, they've done it before, and it's inevitable because China is 95% self-sufficient in coal, thermal coal, and so they don't really need our coal. And they got caught short, and they did actually accelerate imports in the first couple of months of this year because of the pandemic hitting their migrant workforce. But now that the workforce in China is back in place, the economy is back to where it was a year ago, now they have excess supply, and so invariably they're going to cut back on imports. And what better than to cut back on Australian imports and teach the Australian government a lesson? It's also worth bearing in mind that India is the second largest importer of thermal coal in the world, and the headlines out of India today are very telling. Right, this is literally the headline from the Energy World Economic Times newspaper: thermal coal imports for blending to be eliminated in 2021.
Tim Buckley from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Ausmine, which represents medium-sized businesses in the mining sector, say that the sector, though, is still robust and exports from Newcastle were at record levels in April. And while new projects are on hold, there's only one other mine in Australia that's been mothballed in this period. We'll get some reaction to that coal news from the Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, shortly. But before we do that, we'll get some weather details now from Jordan Natara at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Michael.
So the East Coast low, is that out of the picture now or is still hanging around a little bit?
It's still affecting areas of Lord Howe Island off the east coast of New South Wales, but generally the effect on the actual mainland has definitely eased off. Large surf has dissipated, though it is still hazardous during these early hours for parts of the mid-north coast and far northern coastlines, and that's generally due to the amount of energy that's associated within these large waves itself. That, again, is on the way out, and we are seeing basically a trough brushing across the south today, which is bringing very light rain, potentially most likely verga, through parts of the southern inland. So we did see some reflectivity on the radar from Mildura earlier this morning, but nothing has hit any of the gauges out west, and we are expecting a continuation of similar conditions as we move into the afternoon for areas of the Riverina and southwest slopes. Well, we are forecasting generally around 0 to about a millimetre over most of the Riverina, but again, most of those areas are going to probably see just some light verga falling through most of the afternoon. Moving into Tuesday, we are going to be moving towards seeing this trough move across into the southeast. So again, it's not going to be very much. It may be a couple of drops around during the afternoon and morning areas for the southwest slopes, as well as some showers in the far northeast of the state tomorrow. And further into the week, we are going to see some generally high-pressure systems lingering over the most of the states, and some coastal showers, unfortunately, for Friday. And into the weekend, we see the next major frontal system coming across the state. So late Saturday, brushing into the far west, and then moving quickly across the state into Sunday, with a secondary front quickly passing over again on Monday, bringing some stronger westerly winds. And the likelihood is that we will see sheep graziers warnings being reintroduced into the weekend period, into the early new week, for again the fact that we are going to be seeing some additional precipitation attached to cooler conditions and stronger winds.
And much rain in it, and what sort of areas might expect a bit of rain?
It's going to be broader nature at the moment. There is still uncertainty with the timing of this front, but really we are looking at not anything in significant terms. We are looking at a couple of millimetres over most areas, and a lot of this is contained around the Alpine and generally the higher parts of the southern and central ranges. What we are really looking at in those period of times is the strength of the wind. So it is the idea that we are going to see increased winds with those cooler temperatures bringing that risk of, the likelihood of issuing of those sheep graziers warnings.
Okay, so not a lot of rain, but a big drop in temperature again when that front comes through. Is that what we're seeing?
That's right. So we are looking at the next few days seeing generally a trend of around average temperatures. But as we move towards that period where we see that cold front move across, we are going to see again those temperatures dropping below zero, particularly as we move towards early next week and those post-frontal conditions. So temperatures dropping below zero for a large number of areas as we move towards Tuesday morning. But in the lead up to that, we are going to see a drop in maximum temperatures for the daytime down towards the teens as a maximum for areas of the southern inland, as well as for northeastern, northern inland, still temperatures around average into the 20s, but still we are going to see by the new week those maximum temperatures starting to drop again back in towards those temperatures in the teens, and even some areas may see maximum temperatures around 10 degrees as they're moving into that sort of area of Tuesday.
Okay, Jordan, thanks for that.
That's okay, Michael.
Jordan Nataro at the Bureau, 21 minutes to 1 on the Country Hour. Well, talking about coal, going back to that story about coal and the problems with the Peabody mine and some other mines and some issues with the price. Well, earlier today, the Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, responded to the impact and the issues that COVID is having on the coal industry, and also the issue of prices going to free fall, and also markets in China and India for our coal are actually appearing to be drying up. And on that issue, he's speaking here with Michael Kavanagh.
Well, our $140 million package is about those keystone industries that have been severely impacted, and we engage with New South Wales farmers. This is why I'm a bit surprised to see New South Wales farmers now saying, you know, what about the red meat market and the red meat industry? They were at the heart of everything we've done. They actually were part of the conversations, and at no point did they raise that issue. But at the same time, I mean, you know, we're limited in what we can do, and the dairy farmers have had the significant infrastructure damage. But don't forget everyone else that's been impacted by fires has have received the $75,000. Some may have even received an additional $10,000 small business grant. But what we recognise is those dairy farmers, the infrastructure that was impacted by the fires in those areas of the South Coast specifically, where, you know, not just one or two farmers, but almost that whole industry on its knees. That's why we made these decisions. But as I said, I'm happy to look at a few other options, and we'll look at that. But right now, they were the decisions we made in conjunction with all those sectors: viticulture, the forestry industry, the dairy industry. You know, of course, the trawler industry, those guys, we've got some issues around what's happened in the waterways and what has occurred. The oyster industries themselves, the same issue. But, you know, these farmers, these dairy farmers, actually lost infrastructure, lost cattle herds. They lost the breeders for the future. So you've got to measure against the direct impacts. And that's how we've made this assessment. As I said, we'll sit down again. I've spoken to my agency today to sit down again with the sectors and see what else we can do. And, you know, at this stage, we're still also waiting for the federal government to come to the table. They were going to announce other industry packages, so we're waiting to see where they want to invest their money. But at this stage, we haven't seen that, except outside of forestry, where they put some money on the table. We've got $70 million set aside for forestry. They've announced 15 to match ours, which I think is a bit on the low side, but we'll accept that. But it's not just the New South Wales government. The federal government's got to have a look at their industry packages. We set surpluses aside for a rainy day, and in this case, it wasn't a rainy day. It was the firestorm, and now COVID. And our revenues over the next 12 months are down by about $10 billion. So, you know, where we're now, everything that we do and every dollar we spend is on the credit card. So the days are gone where the New South Wales government can just write an open cheque. So we've got to be very careful where that investment is. This is the taxpayers' money, not ours. And, you know, our deficit, our debt is going to be significant as we get out of COVID. So it's not as easy as it was once upon a time, but that doesn't mean we can't look at it, but it will have an impact on the budget.
That, of course, was John Barilaro talking about the concerns about those bushfire grants, the funding of $140 million, saying that industry and New South Wales were actually consulted and asked about what areas needed the most help, and dairy was put at the top of the list, and sheep and cattle producers weren't put on the radar, he says, by industry people. So he says, though, he will look at further help, if possible, with the federal government. Well, let's go back to that story, if the computer allows me to go back to the story about coal, because the Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, also responded to the impact that COVID's having on the coal industry, with those prices going into free-fall, and markets in China and India for our coal appear to be drying up. And as I said, he's speaking with Michael Kavanagh.
Well, our $140 million pack.
Well, the computer doesn't like playing that, so we'll just see if we can rejig things a little bit and try and finally get to that audio that we've been trying to get to for quite some time now. So let's see if we can rearrange the computer. It's doing some funny things today. Let's see if we can go to John Barilaro now and Michael Kavanagh.
The Indian government has said no more thermal coal from next year, and that's going to put a big hole in your budget.
Absolutely. I mean, we rely heavily on royalties from mining. Coal alone is close to $2 billion for us in New South Wales, so that's significant. There's also been a decline globally in relation to, because of COVID, so we've got some of our mining companies having to shut down their workforce for a couple of months while they reset. That will, and we'll have to plan for the future. But, you know, we're going through a period at the moment, but there is a future for coal. The global demand for coal, on best estimates, is still going to be there till 2040, 2050. Australian coal is still highly regarded and the cleanest of all, so there's still a strong market for it. But yeah, there are going to be countries that are going to make certain decisions. India have decided to do what they have decided, but you know, the coal industry, the mining industry, is still very important to us. But we'll have to work through that. We'll see what the revenues look like. When I say that the budget revenues are down by about $10 billion in income, you know, each and every week during COVID, I mean, we're losing $1.6 billion in the economy. That's significant. That's food and fibre. That is mining, resources, tourism, service industries. No industry's been left behind in this one. Everyone's been impacted.
A very stark example is Peabody's closing of the Wamba mine for 59 days.
Yep.
What are you doing in regards to that?
Well, again, I mean, that's a decision, a commercial decision for those companies, and they've had to make that decision because of coal prices and the coal demand. We are talking about their underground component of that mine, and therefore that's where they're standing down employees for 59 days, and they'll work with those employees. All these companies have place support programs in relation to those employees, but this is the reality of COVID. This is the reality of a global shutdown of economies and the price of coal. So again, an issue. We'll be working with Peabody's. We'll be working with the sector, but up to this point, it was actually the mining sector that's kept us going during the crisis. We've worked hard with them so that we didn't have to have the shutdown or lockdown of the industry like others, and they've kept us going. But now the reality of the global market, global demand, is going to impact that sector.
Well, with the mining sector being so crucial previously, will there be a bit of a quid pro quo if Peabody come knocking on the door and ask for some sort of assistance?
Oh, look, we're always open for that. But, you know, at the end of the day, these companies set money aside for the future. They haven't asked that. They're making a commercial decision right now. And that commercial decision they're making is actually about protecting its long-term investment and being part of the mining landscape here in New South Wales. So they haven't reached out. But, you know, I'm always open to hear if any industry, any sector is needing support. We've got to make sure we get out of this crisis. And one of the things I think we've learned from COVID is food production, manufacturing, being able to control our own destiny in the future is something that the Australian people want, and that's why there's got to be a focus on what we do with our sectors.
And on the easing of the guidelines, we're seeing that in the case of wineries and tasting rooms, they will also be able to open up to the public from June 1. What sort of restrictions would they have to serve meals?
Yeah, no, we were finalising that yesterday, so we caught up with the industries, the AHA, clubs in New South Wales, the catering and restaurant industry yesterday. We're finalising those guidelines, but no, when it comes to those cellar doors, those wineries, we believe that we'll follow suit what's happened in South Australia, where you won't have to serve food. A lot of them do, you know, serve cheese platters and bits like that, which is great, but a little bit of a different rule for those cellar doors.
And there still will be restrictions on the numbers similar to the hotels. Will it be the same number of the hotels? What sort of figures?
Yeah, the cap's 50, 50 per room, you know, per dining room, or in this case, those tasting rooms, but subject to the 4 square metre rule. So, you know, if they've only got a small room, they'll only be capped to the 4 square metre rule. That you know, when we get through June, the reality here is that cap of 50 will probably be lifted on 1 July or in July at some point, and it'll go back to the 4 square metre rule, the 1.5, and that's going to be the new norm, God knows, for 12 to 18 months.
That's John Barilaro there on the coal issue and other COVID issues. Well, COVID-19 is having a mixed effect on the livelihood of commercial fishermen, with some parts of the sector there holding up while others have suffered a significant downturn, also from the bushfires as well. The Professional Fishermen's Association, Tricia Beattie, says a survey of members shows, like many food producers, these fishermen rely on direct sales to restaurants and cafes, and they've been hit badly. But also, they've been hit badly by the inability to get any assistance in regards to bushfires too.
No, we were actually extremely disappointed and a bit in shock that the commercial fishing sector was not included within the assistance. And we're a bit bemused about how such a majorly impacted industry could have been, it appears, forgotten by the New South Wales government. We were significantly impacted by bushfires. We had the guys down at Eden, Southland Fish Supplies. They didn't have fresh, clean water to be able to use for ice for many weeks. They lost power, so they couldn't even make ice, couldn't process. And then at the end of the day, because the fires were surrounding that area, they couldn't send product to either Sydney or Melbourne or anywhere. So those guys were busy fighting fires. We had communities' children sitting on the trawlers to keep them safe. And yet, for some reason, we've been forgotten off the assistance package. In addition to that, our industry is still suffering somewhat from the fires, because after the fires, we had all the rain and all the ash came flooding out of the river systems, and we had major ash slicks all over the waterways and out to sea, which actually caused lots of problems for our vessels and our engines.
and elsewhere on the issue of COVID-19. Wineries, breweries and distilleries in the states, on the state's far north coast, are looking forward to a significant boost in business with the easing of restrictions from Monday. They'll now be allowed up to 50 customers on the premises at one time for tastings, with no bookings of more than 10 people and subject to a 4-square-metre social distancing rule, as Kim Honan reports.
Reopening at Cellar Door will come as a huge relief to the region's largest winery, Cassegrain Wines, near Port Macquarie. The business relies heavily on direct sales to consumers, with the Cellar Door accounting for 50% of its domestic sales. Managing Director John Cassegrain.
That's going to have an enormous, well, we hope anyway, it's going to have an enormous impact on our performance. We're gearing up now. We're taking the opportunity to freshen up our Cellar Door. Yeah. 3 weeks ago, we, for the life of us, didn't think that we'd be opening up our Cellar Door for tasting as soon as the 1st of June. And we're still getting clarification from the New South Wales government that we will be able to do free tastings. But one thing for sure is, people are travelling around a little bit more. They may not be able to go interstate, but when you've got, beautiful locations like Port Macquarie, Coffs Harbour, dare I say, the far north coast in New South Wales, you don't need to go to Queensland or any other place. We've got it all here.
When the winery was forced to close due to COVID-19 restrictions, its revenue dropped 90%. Its export market had also taken a dramatic hit. China cancelled a $50,000 order, and the bullet train in Japan didn't need wine.
From early March, we got notification that our March order was going to be the last order for some time, because our major customer in Japan is the bullet train, and with the lockdown in Japan and the outbreak, people are obviously not travelling on trains, so the number of passengers on the bullet train is down 95%. So where the Japanese were ordering wines on a 3-weekly to 4-weekly basis and have been doing so for 20 years, we haven't had an order since March, and at this stage they've got no idea when they think they will reorder. But more than likely not before September. That's had a massive impact on our revenue, obviously. We're hoping to get an order to China within the next 3-4 weeks. Having said that, the political stouts that the Australian government's having with the Chinese government and the Chinese have put tariffs on barley. They've made life difficult for some of the Australian abattoirs and have indicated they may make life difficult for wine imports. So our importers are saying, look, until we know what's happening between our governments, we're reluctant to buy any wine, because when we export to China, we get paid up front. So the risk will be for our importer that when the wine arrives in China, the wine can't leave the wharf for any technical reason.
John Cassegrain. And further north to the Tweed Valley, Husk Distillers at Tumbulgum has had a busy few months. Despite a halting of its exports and the shutdown of bars, restaurants and its own premises, they've built a veggie patch for the kitchen and Argentinian barbecue and started producing hand sanitizer. Harriet Messenger says they had to adapt very quickly.
We've managed to retain all of our permanent staff, which was really important to us. Just in a bit of an altered capacity, for instance, our chef, who's very excited to be back cooking this week, he's been, on the bottling line and making sanitizer and filling sanitizer bottles, because we did pivot to sanitizer production for several weeks, which was fantastic to keep our hands busy. And we were also able to provide that service to the community as well. And we managed to be in a position that we could actually donate and offer a lot of really affordable, either fully donate or offer really affordable discounted sanitizer for essential services and frontline services. So we were pretty excited that we were able to do that.
What sort of drop in your sales have you seen though?
We lost 45% of our channels, like hospitality, so on-premise, bars, restaurants and that sort of thing. And travel retail was a big one as well, so all of the duty-free sort of shut down. So that was a loss of channels. But because of those big major bottle shops, which have been able to stay open, as well as our online channels and the sanitizer, we've been able to remain in a fairly positive position.
While Husk is excited about restrictions easing and allowing up to 50 customers at once, they are frustrated that the Queensland border remains closed.
until the border is open, we will be, you know, the weekends we should be, we'll be fine. We should be enough people locally who want to come, and enough people who have passes from the Gold Coast who want to come. But until the border is open, it's going to really restrict business. And I think that's for all businesses in the Tweed. We're all going to be limping until the border's reopened.
Harriet Messenger is from Huss Distillers in Tumblegum in the Tweed Valley. It's 5-1. Time for markets. Let's go to Casino Cattle and Doug Robson.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain steady for a yarding of 1,565 head. Around 1,000 young cattle were sold, consistently mainly of vealers and weaners. Quality was fairly good in a market that saw most of the young cattle go to restockers. Weaner steers held firm, selling from 334 to 462 cents, while restocker weaner heifers, they were 10 cents dearer in places, selling from 340 to 430. Feeder steers sold from 372 to 380, and the heifers 290 to 342, trade heifers up to 392. One processor not operating this week, resulting in bullocks and steers down by 10 cents. They sold from 306 to 324, heifers topped at 325. Heavy cows were firm to 8 cents cheaper, however medium weight cows were slightly dearer. D2 cows sold from 250 to 278 cents, 3-score medium weights averaged 284, and heavy cows sold from 285 to 312 cents, best of the heavy bulls, 310 cents. Doug Robson, Casino.
Let's go to Carcor Sheep and Lambs and David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers lifted by 1,100 for a yarding of 6,300 lambs. It was a very good quality yarding with some top heavyweight lambs yarded along with a pretty good selection of trade weights. There were also some well-finished merino lambs, but very few lambs to suit the restockers. Trade lambs were $11 to $14 dearer, selling from $170 to $234, to average between $9.55 and $9.75 cents a kilogram, with plenty of sales in excess of 1,000 cents per kilogram. Heavyweight lambs were 6 to 10 dearer, with the over 24 kilogram 4 scores selling from $220 to $267, and they averaged between $8.70 and $9.20 cents. Merino lambs were $10 dearer, with the trade weight selling from $168 to $184. Few lambs to the restockers were firm, selling from 142 to 159. Hoggets sold to 240. It was a good quality yarding of 1,750 mutton, where the light and medium weight sheep were firm and the heavyweight sheep were dearer. Merino ewes sold from 110 to 205, while the crossbred ewes sold from 135 to 253. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
Thanks, David. Let's go to Yash Sheep and Lambs now and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers slipped to 4,100. The quality remains good, with the bulk of the lambs trade in heavyweights and most were coming off crop. The market lifted 6 to 8 on the trade weight lambs and remained firm on the heavyweights, with one less order operating. Store lambs were very limited. Trade lambs 187 to 219 to average 890 to 930. The heavy lambs 206 to 235, with extra heavies reaching 275 and average from 760 to 850. Trade merinos lifted 8, reaching 186, and heavyweights 220. Mutton numbers doubled to 4,600, and the quality was fair to good. Prices lift to 8 to 10 across most of the yarding. The medium weight ewes 160 to 190, heavy crossbred ewes reached 265, and merinos 222, and very heavy crossbred wethers 290. And this has been Graham Richard at Yass.
Thanks, Graham. Let's go to Mossvale now, and with the cattle details there, here's David Kent.
Good afternoon. A slight decrease in numbers for a total yarding of 990 good quality cattle. There was 130 outstanding heavy steers reaching 387 cents, making from $2,000 to $2,400 per head. Yearling and vealers were well supplied, and there was 80 cows, selling to a very strong market. Prime vealers 3 cents better, 401 to 438. Trade yearling steers lifted 4, 378 to 441. Heifers to processors firm to too easier, quality related, 355 to 438. Medium weight feeder steers gained 4, 389 to 434. Heavy feeder steers firm to average 392. Interest from restockers remains very strong. Well-bred vealer steers 10 dearer, 414 to 534. Vealer heifers also dear at average 408. Grown steers much dearer, 312, 380 to 387. Heavy 3 and 4 score cows, 4 better, 278 to 304. The best heavyweight bull reached 320 cents per kilogram. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
Thanks, David. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. And in terms of some of the texts, didn't get a lot of time to go through many texts today, so apologies for that. We were pretty tight on time and we had some technical issues with some of the stories. So on the rainfall, though, we did get a text from Rod at Lake Ajeligo who was saying they've had 2 millimetres of rain, so it's not really raining out there. But at Lake Ajeligo, where they've had some pretty dry times, so they need about 20 or 40 millimetres at the moment, but they've just had two from the recent rain that's passed through. Maybe we'll get a bit more on the weekend. That's the forecast, and we'll have to wait and see, though. It's early days for the forecast, as they say. They're not sure how much is coming. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's heading up to news time.